One of the things that we've talked about so many times on this program before, Michael, is as people bring forth stories about the afterlife and death and reincarnation, mm-hmm. but nobody really has what I consider to be some kind of evidence, hard evidence. Mm-hmm. You talk a little bit about this in your book.
Uh-huh.
Tell me about this.
Well, I mean, I use the term science to characterize the approach to this, to the question of life after death, but you have to remember that it's not science the way we do chemistry or physics. It's psychological science. It's, in a way, it's like history. People have experiences, and people have been having, you know, there are reports of ghostly encounters that go back to the ancient world. And they're a constant in human experience. I mean, taking that as one of several types of experiences that people have. And what began with in 1882, when a group of philosophers and classical scholars in England decided to look at these experiences in an objective way and try to rule out the exaggerations and the misperceptions and see if there's something really going on here, and then try to come up with the best possible explanation. Is it delusion? Is it fraudulent? Is it exaggeration? Can these experiences be explained in some way? Or is the best explanation relating to survival of bodily death? And in that sense, by the way, I mean, you know, philosophers talk about inference to the best explanation, and that pretty much is the method used try to pin down narratives or stories for which the best explanation seems to be that somebody survived death. And this has been going on for a long time, and I was amazed when I got into the subject and started to look closely. I was rather amazed to find that there were these often very compelling narratives. But I have to say this, George, in my opinion, I don't think we can produce a sort of knockdown proof of life after death, but I think we can come up with a reasonable case for it, and I think it's important to try to do that. I think from a psychological point of view and a practical point of view, it can be very helpful for many people. Not everyone seems to care, and I also think that a lot of people just don't want to think about this stuff at all. But I agree with Carl Jung when he said that we need to come to grips with the idea of our death, and it's probably psychologically a healthy thing to try to form an image of some kind of continuity.
Well, what if though, that all these stories of spirits, even though people truly see things mm-hmm. on the foot of their bed and premonitions, and I mean, strange things have occurred, there's no mm-hmm. doubt about that.
Right.
But what if for some reason, in terms of actual death, Michael, what if it's just the brain doing whatever it does, and then when you die, it dies with you, and that's it, and there's really nothing on the other side?
Right.
I mean, that destroys, that shatters our belief in any kind of spirituality and everything else. And of course, I don't believe that it doesn't exist. But what if I'm wrong, and what if you're wrong?
We may be wrong, and that's the risk. And as a matter of fact, now that you mention this, I recall from my student days as a classical scholar a statement of Socrates in the dialogue, the Phaedo, which describes his own beliefs just before he was about to be executed. And he's trying to persuade his companions that he will survive death. And he says this is a noble risk, this belief. So it is. There is an element of risk, of uncertainty, but nevertheless, there are some stories, some narratives, some experiences that I find very suggestive of some form of survival. Maybe I could give, let's say, one example from a famous one from the literature. And I mean, I won't go through the details because the details are sort of tedious. But the basic idea is that a guy has been dead for 4 years, and he starts appearing to one of his sons in a series of apparitions or dreamlike apparitions, and he tells his son about the location of his last will, the will that he never actually revealed to anybody.
After he had died.
After he had died.
All right.
And he gives a description of the whereabouts of this will. The son, whose name was Chafin, gets another person as a witness, because he realizes this may be important.
Sure.
And goes to the location. It was a rather obscure place. It was hidden inside of an old Bible, inside of an old coat somewhere. No living person knew where this will was. Sure enough, the will is there. Now, the beautiful thing about this case is that it was taken to court and probated, and the next to the last will was overturned, and the final will that was found, due to the intelligence of the deceased man himself, was rendered valid, and the property of that family was redistributed. It's a classic case. It's written up in the annals of psychical research, and there are records of this case in the history of the law of North Carolina.
All right, but what if the son was clairvoyant and just had the ability to remote view, let's say?
That's a possibility. That is a possibility. The only thing I find difficult with that interpretation is, why did it take him 4 years to do that? Why did he conjure up these apparitions of his father telling him? And finally,
good point,
why did he continue to see his father's apparitions after he found the will? Those three reasons strike me as supporting, not absolutely proving, but supporting the survival hypothesis. You got to be a kind of a lawyer here to deal with this material, and you know, it's in the end, it's you try to come to the best possible explanation. Now, this is just one case, but it's a striking one, I think.